You are listening to The Pulse, Rod Murray's e-learning tech podcast.
Number 180, Learning Technology Entrepreneurs. Hi, this is Rod Murray. Welcome back to my podcast. That little teaser was from a song called Fly, Fly, Fly by singer-songwriter Adrina Thorpe. She says she's influenced by Sarah McLachlan, Tori Amos, and Coldplay. So I think you'll like it. She has a sweet voice. And again, I'll play the full song at the end of my podcast. This podcast is sponsored by Inside Higher Ed, the online source for news, opinion, and jobs for all of higher education. I also invite you to follow me on Twitter. My handle is RodsPods. As always, I post links to all the things we talk about on my show notes at www.rodspulsepodcast.com. Well, I have a special podcast for you this month. It's a recording of a panel discussion called Learning Technology Entrepreneurs, Case Studies from Concept to Market. It was recorded at a unique joint meeting of the Pennsylvania, Delaware, New Jersey Distance Learning Association and the Venture Cafe located in University City Science Center in Philadelphia. If you're not familiar with the Venture Cafe, it's a great venue. They have wonderful programs, free programs every Thursday afternoon. Check it out in University City Science Center. So as mentioned, this meeting featured a moderated panel discussion of learning technology entrepreneurs who share their personal journeys from initial concept to bringing their product and service to the marketplace. So, of course, this points out that Philadelphia is a hotbed of technology innovation. So I'm familiar with most of these entrepreneurs, and in fact, I've interviewed some of them on my podcast. I think you'll find it to be a very interesting conversation, especially if you're an entrepreneur or an entrepreneur wannabe. The panel was moderated by Louis Struckoff, who is the executive director of Padla. And the panelists include Michael Eisman, founder of Learning by Hand. And he invented and wrote himself a wonderful application to help teach algebra to children. Also on the panel is Ethan Kaiser, who's founder of StudyTree, a mobile app which helps to bring students together and help them succeed at school. Another panelist is Shanok Roy, who's the founder and CEO of YellowDig. They have a very interesting twist on a discussion board, a way to really engage your students. And finally, Mustafa Suab, who's the founder and CEO of APHIS. APHIS offers a complete platform for assessment and continuous improvement for your campus. So without further ado, let me turn it over to the panel discussion where each panelist will introduce themselves and talk about their journey in building their company.
So let's start at the beginning with Ethan. Why don't you tell us about who you are, what company do you have, and what is your product line?
Hi, everybody. So I'm Ethan Kaiser. I'm the CEO and founder of a company called StudyTree. And what we're aiming to do is we built a artificial college advisor that we sell to universities to help students get through their freshman and sophomore year and graduate. Our platform integrates with the gradebook, so we see how students are doing, we see where they're starting to struggle, and then we'll reach out and try to help that student, helping them connect with study groups or on-campus resources. We have about 80,000 students registered with our platform, and we're both Canada and the United States.
Are we doing introductions or?
Definitely do the intro. Tell them who you are, tell them about your product, and tell them about the.
All of the above.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Mustafa. I'm the founder, CEO, and servant leader of APHIS. APHIS is an assessment management platform for higher ed. Thank you.
Yeah.
My fan club in the back. Some of our team members are back there supporting me. I'm very excited about tonight's panel because I think entrepreneurship, particularly around ed tech, is very important. It's an area that has a lot of potential, and certainly is an area where we can all make significant social impact. So, certainly we are blessed with many great academic partners who came along for our journey. And we doubled last 2 years, and we doubled already this year. And we're based out of 15th and Walnut in Philadelphia. So when somebody asks, like, you know, are there great edtech companies growing out of Philadelphia, you can say, I know at least four, right? And certainly it's been an interesting journey. Personally, I'm a product of U.S. higher education system. I'm a first generation student. I became a U.S. I became a U.S. citizen in 2012, a proud patriot now, but I will say my journey began with the U.S. higher education system, and that's why I came here. And EdTech is an area where I can give back to the enterprise that I'm so grateful for. So with that, I turn over to Michael.
I'm Michael Eisman. And I have a company, Learn by Hand, and our product right is Algebra by Hand. So it's very specialized. It's a product that helps students become better, faster, more accurate, more confident in just algebra, solving actually just linear equations. And so I'm probably the little fish in the sea. What I do is something very, very specific, I'm kind of a nerd. I'm not as much of a business guy, but I'm learning, and that's part of my business venture. But I'm having a fantastic time, really enjoying the ride, and being given ample opportunity to be creative and contribute, in some cases, give back to the community.
Hi, I'm Shanak Roy, and the founder and CEO of Yellow Day. We are out of Philadelphia, and our product is essentially creating virtual learning communities. So, you know, people in this room, you know, people can meet each other and learn from each other, but the world that you're going to live in is people can learn from anywhere, but the value of a community never diminishes. So we have built a product that helps do that in a very simple and easy way. And my background, I am an immigrant from India. I'm a first-time entrepreneur. So if anybody wants to know how to become an entrepreneur, don't have any formal background in education, so I accidentally ended up in this phase, but I love it. So if you want to kind of find it out, to kind of, you know, how to start a company in this phase, you may or may not have much experience, I can help. And in Yale Day, you know, we work with about 50 or so universities now, about 300,000 students who are using our platform every day. Thanks.
All right, so we have people in various stages of their company. But stage one, how did you come up with this idea? I mean, why this? Why not cows or something like that? So tell us, what sparked the idea?
Well, for me, it was my junior year of college. I was just got out of wrestling practice. In the shower, where all the ideas come from, you know.
Is that true?
Absolutely true. I mean, I'm bathing.
Showers
is where you do all your thinking. Okay, it's down this trip here. And a lot of my friends, you know, it was wrestling, I don't know what it was, but they were struggling in college. And I thought to myself, why don't you go to the math center or the writing center? And they go, oh, I don't know about it. So I'm like, there should be an app that can identify a struggling student and push them to the right thing, kind of like what I did. And it just kind of one thing led to another. I built it. We won some competitions, got some grant money, and the rest is history. So it's just that idea that you come up with, find a team, make it happen, and see how it goes.
Tell us what stage you're going.
That's always a tricky question. Stage. We have revenue, customers. We've raised a little bit of money. So stage of like late seed, maybe early Series A, I guess we'd say. Slightly funded, slightly poor.
Okay, so I'm sure a lot of people in the audience feel the same way or in the same situation.
How about yourself?
I'm a Drexel grad, yes, go drag. After I graduated, in fact, I was an enterprising student. I was doing consulting, and in fact, I started my first company while I was an undergrad at Drexel. Following that, it was a technology solutions firm, and following that, I did projects in and around the university also, so it didn't fly too far from the nest. And one of the projects we did was to help School of Biomedical Engineering track their goals and document evidence of meeting those goals for accreditation purposes. And it became this very interesting area where I was almost flabbergasted. The lack of analytics and data that drove the learning journeys and academic improvement processes at various programs, it became this kind of enlightenment process. And similar to my colleague here, we then got recognized there. We built a tool that became of interest to many others. And I realized that could be a software that would help other universities. In 2009, we tech transferred it out of Drexel, which was a fun experience. And my first company incubated the second company, APHIS, which is another interesting way to develop kind of like companies, right? By 2012, we had universities like UW-Madison, Texas, UT Dallas.
Madison.
Wisconsin. Go Badgers, right? And those are amazing colleagues. So, it was the core value of partnership, I think, that we brought to bear on our relationships, being a very small enterprise. These visionary leaders in higher ed who saw a better way to collect basically evidence of achievements at various levels of the institution and doing it in a systemic way gave us credence, gave us the mentorship and adult supervision that we needed. And here we are in at the end of 2018, we were 25 universities that included Texas A&M, the single largest campus in the U.S. And just recently we signed on, I think we're up to 37 right now. I keep losing track. But it's been an interesting and a phenomenal journey. As far as where we are, that's also very interesting. We're the only self-funded ed tech company in our specific vertical. And we are going up against what I call the resistance. And they're the evil empire. There's a couple of rollout companies that are part of, in both cases, billion-dollar funds. And a few other providers that are, like, well-funded. We suffered through the revenue-based growth. And we resisted the temptation to add jet fuel in the way of raising funds. And we've been very much approached a number of times to do that. But I'm glad we didn't. Raising funds through investment is an expensive way of doing it. And revenue is a much better and more sustainable way to do it. And currently we are going through restructuring, and we're essentially doing a seed round. It's a symbolic seed round. We invited one of our mentors to become our chairman of the board and to formalize our organization as a company. And so we're kind of late. I mean, we're past seed round, but I call it a seed round, and we might do a first round in about 18 to 24 months, depending on our growth rate. Currently, we're about 160% growth rate, which is crazy. So, that's it.
Okay, this will take the whole rest of the time. So. I've got to be the old guy on the panel. I worked for DuPont for about 30 years as a chemical engineer. And most of the time I make inks for inkjet printers. So if you ever went to the store and bought an inkjet cartridge for $30. That money went all to me. So you, thanks to you, you built up my 401k, you built up all that stuff. My wife and I were ready for retirement. And then I was doing a lot of volunteer work with a wonderful organization called A Better Chance, ABC. And it's a program that's gone I grew up with in Wisconsin. I grew up, that's where the strange Milwaukee accent is that I have, is Wisconsin. And we had it in boarding school when I went away to boarding school. It's a wonderful program when they take African-American kids from terrible school districts and we bring them into our school district. And we have them go to our public schools on our nickel, on our dime. And so we had an ABC house in Swarthmore, Pennsylvania, which is where I lived for 24 years. And I was Mr. Mike. So I was the guy who went into the house in the evenings and a volunteer. I was a completely volunteer. And I would help them with anything, math or science. Because I knew all the math and science that they needed to know. And I ended up teaching them, I found a lot of algebra. Because they're of that age where they need to learn a lot of algebra. In the United States, we teach algebra differently than they teach it in India. You're aware of that.
Yep.
Okay? So in the United States, we teach algebra in terms of moving terms and factors, applying equivalent arithmetic operations to both sides of an equation. That's how we teach in the United States. In India, and in most of the rest of the civilized world, now I do say that, but in India and in Malaysia, in Russia, in Korea, and you name it, lots of places, China, they think of it in terms of moving terms and factors, right? In your head, that's the way you were taught. And so I would hand these kids an algebra problem and hand it over to them and give it to them, and I could visualize the answer immediately. I'd give it to them, and I'd sit, and I'd wait, and I'd wait, and I'd wait. And finally, they would come back, and they would come to give me the answer. And so these were very smart kids. These were kids just as smart as I was. So the question that I had to ask myself is, why couldn't these kids do it as fast as I could? Now, you say to yourself, okay, you're an engineer with 30 years of experience. Of course, you're going to be faster than they are. But my belief is that that's a cop-out. That the job of an educator is to take what's in an expert's head and put it in their student's head as quickly and as efficiently as possible. So I thought about what was happening in my head. And I realized I was doing it the way you did in India. I call the skill advanced procedural fluency. And so I thought, well, geez, I could just create software that enables students to be able to, on the web, to move terms and factors through gestures so they could solve algebraically gestures and do things the way most STEM professionals do. Well, I didn't know the program, so I just taught myself, okay? And it wasn't hard for me, you're an engineer, right? You can do that kind of thing, and there's so many wonderful resources there on the web for programming, and I became a full-stack developer just in my spare time. So then I've got the nerd part of it, and I told you I'm kind of a nerd. So I've got that side. So I finish my career at DuPont. I go to small business development, SBDCs in my area. I go talk, I get advisors, and I say, how can I turn this into a business? And so I'm at the point where I've got a little revenue, I'm slowly ramping up. My wife made it clear to me that I'm not to put our retirement at risk. And so I'm at a very different stage, right? So when I'm at a different stage than these people, so I have to do it my way. And so my way is, and I'm trying to do it revenue-based as well. So I build it up one step at a time. It's a very slow way, but I'm not in a hurry. I'm enjoying myself. I'm doing what I like. I love working with teachers. I love working with students. And so I can do the things, do it the way I want to do it. It's a wonderful luxury. Almost nobody gets to be an entrepreneur the way I'm getting to be an entrepreneur, but it's a fun way to do it. And it's what I want to do.
All right, thank you. So how did you come up with the concept?
Sure.
And what stage are you in?
So my concept, you know, I was an immigrant in the country. So I worked for about 10 years for a variety of companies, consulting and FMC corporation, right, in Philadelphia. So that's how I moved to Philly. And, you know, one day one of my friends actually called me, a very good friend of mine from college, and we used to discuss about starting businesses, but I had to get corporate ladder career doing pretty well. And he's saying that, Sean, well, how is life? And I said, yeah, life is great. I'm doing all these good things, and I'm earning so much of money, and it's all great, and this is exactly what I wanted to do all the time. He listens to everything, and he says that, that sounds really boring. Really boring. I mean, I know you. You used to do something interesting and exciting, and this is something not what you want to do for your life. I mean, that night I remember, and I spoke to my wife, like, you know what, that really struck me. Like, you know, I was 10 years into it, so wasn't that I was, you know, like, buying all the way in. And that night I actually started thinking about, I want to start a company. So that's how I got started. So nothing to do with education directly, but it was purely a life thing. And the concept came to me because I graduated and I worked for 10 years, and I saw that how I was learning. In the company, I was learning every day, like every employee, everybody has to learn. And the only thing I learned is by Google, by all these places, by all these like free resources on YouTube, like YouTube and everything else. And then I thought that, hey, 10 years back, I didn't learn like that. Now I'm learning like this. This is the future. And think about it, like learning from anywhere, and then add this component of like community of people who are like you, who wants to solve the same problem like you, it could be very powerful. So I got really excited by that idea, and I kind of pitched to anybody and everybody who was moving around me. And I got a lot of feedback. I mean, that's one thing I would say. Like, if you have an idea, like, don't build it. Like, pitch it as many people as possible. I did that, and some people actually liked it, and they started working with me. That's why I got started. And, you know, long story short, I mean, we are doing education. We work with companies also now. And I'm, you know, I believe in revenue-based, which is what I really believe in. You want to keep them in control. The product that we're building, we have a lot of investment in technology, so we have to raise money. But we are fortunate to have very good investors in the company, like Ben Franklin Technology Partners. Amazing local investor. If you want to get started, they're really good. We have another investor called Shree Capital. We have Musketeer Capital. These are all local investors. There are investors available. It takes a little bit of hustle, more than maybe New York or Bay Area, but it's there. They are looking for certain things. If you want to talk to me about it, I can talk to you about it as well. And, you know, stage-wise, we raised about $3 of funding, so, you know, whatever that means.
Okay, so we have four different companies, four entrepreneurs, but I think one thing that I'm hearing is this all came from a personal experience, which turned into a passion, which now is a company. So I think I just defined what makes an entrepreneur. So are there any questions from the audience? I want to hear from the audience. Does anyone have similar experiences that they'd like to share, or have questions to these people who've been down the road? Go ahead.
So, when you're discussing your journey, you said, I built this, then the next step, then the next one. I feel like I built this is kind of the hardest part. Well, when you say you built this, you built your platform, it sounds like both of you are building apps or software. did you hire? What footers did you find? What kind of footing communities did you explore? What people the front end and the back end of your platform?
Okay, so that's a really great question.
So I would just make a comment. My feeling is building the app is not the hardest part. So my feeling is what the my panelists are more skilled, I think, at this than I am. But I think the hardest part is a lot of the things that they're very good at doing. The hardest part is building teams. The hardest part is drawing in customers and for me the fun is finding out what customers want and improving the product according to customers. But I think the business side to me seems the more difficult side because I'm not as trained in that possibly.
Michael, I think that's a great answer, but I would add just one thing to that. Michael, what you refer to as business side, I would like to reframe that as being the passion side. So, you will hear folks talk about, like, follow your passion, you'll be rich and famous in no time. And it doesn't exactly work that way. However, I do believe, so your question alludes to me, let's make an assumption for a minute. You're the idea person, and you have some interest in a specific thing that you want to, you think there is a value in growing. You become the big giant cheerleader for that, right? And that's who I was. In fact, I was our first developer, as a matter of fact. And as good as I'm with people, I'm also okay with technology. But I think very soon I realized my value in kind of pursuing this was more on the passion capital investment. And so in recruiting the folks who became the initial team members in the nucleus were people who shared core values. So I would say core value, like, so when you talk about, like, I said something about partnership earlier. Partnership was an important core value that I saw a way to not only grow but bring in new institutions into our kind of story so they can be contributors. The initial folks who joined me were people who understood when I said partnership, they didn't think, like, what the hell is this guy talking about, right? And those folks also need to become the kind of like the small but continuous investors in the passion capital of the pursuit. So that you cannot have someone who's a mercenary, right? Who's just, you know what, I just want to make good salary and I just want to relax. Probably not a good tech person, right? And oftentimes you'll find tech folks can be, what's the right word here? And I'm kind of geek myself, so I will include myself in this. Can be somewhat, they're driven by the puzzle or the challenge. They're not as interested in the business aspects over their times, right? So you want to make sure someone who will be interested in solving that puzzle or the problem with you from a different angle, which is the technology side. And that would be my few comments that I can make to that. But good luck to you.
Yeah. The one thing I want to mention is that finding a team, as you mentioned, is like, how do you do that? How do you find a team? How do you find developers, right? People underestimate LinkedIn, they underestimate going out to meetups. I mean, that is how I've sourced my team. From the whole entire team I've met, either on LinkedIn or at social meetups. And my best players, my core team, the first guys I brought on, I didn't pay them for like 3 to 6 months. And even then it was below market rate because they understand that if you can pitch them on a product, they truly believe the passion, as we spoke about. You know passion when they're not getting paid market rate. That's when you see passion. So, and at that point, they're already invested in it. It's almost like a sunk cost. Like, well, I'm already this deep into it. it looks like there's a light at the end of the tunnel, so I might as well stick it out for another 6 months. Eventually, you have to pay them something because they have to survive, and their wives or girlfriends will get them shit. But regardless, you can get away with a very early product with very little capital. And if you can't, I think you're doing something wrong. It comes down to being able to tell a great story and motivate people, and then build an MVP and raise capital. Or if that's what we want to do, capital.
And I have met you at a meetup.
So I can attest that you were out there at those meetups.
There's a question right there.
No, I mean,
any question. But the only thing I'll add, I completely agree with everything what you guys said, is just that the first product you're building, don't overinvest. That's the biggest mistake entrepreneurs make, is to overbuild. Because I can almost tell you it's going to be wrong. The first one is going to be wrong. So build as minimum as possible, solve the most important problem, get it to customers. If people are willing to pay for it, then you start building.
Question right there.
You know, I had a bunch of questions to be asking them, but I'd rather you ask the questions because they're better.
Yes, so you mentioned holding out promises to people, you're paying them on the market rates, and with their expectation that they will eventually receive compensation, just compensation in the future. In the interim, are you contractually obliging yourself to them? What do they have to hang their hats on?
Generally, it's a, usually, I mean, from my experience, I think they become like a contractor in which they're paid in equity. And it's like a salary, they're receiving a certain amount of shares every month. So they are building some value. It's just not in the form of currency. It's equity, which one day will become currency, hopefully.
Great question. At least in our case, so I consider myself a servant leader. And I think as such, when you're in the early stages, when you're investing passion capital and expecting people to maybe take less than market salaries, I think the reality is you need to be authentic about it. Authenticity is the key, I think, and certainly you need to be open and honest and transparent about it. And know that even if you have the best people working for peanuts for you, that's not a sustainable model. And your plan should be how to create sustainability in everything you do as you're moving along with it, right? And your team is the single most important resource. So as a leader, I think the first and foremost rule is that you're serving this initial group more than so. In our case, I always say I'm at the bottom of the pyramid in our organization, because I believe serving my team, and early team was the same. I would bring them coffee and stuff, make sure that everyone's happy, especially at a time where we had limited funds to like cover the exorbitant salaries. But I think everyone saw the higher than just the group of us ideals around it. And again, it takes a certain right kind of individual, core values were shared. And everyone is actually glad they were along for the journey, which is something that I'm proud to say. And we're now up to 20 people on our team, and one is greater than this, so I couldn't ask anything better. So, a little bit maybe an indirect answer to your question for us.
I think the part that you're going to go into providing people with an equity process, right? How does that happen? That's the point.
Can you repeat the question? So the question is, how do you basically provide equity as a benefit, right? As a supplement to payment, maybe. So actually, that's a great point. A vesting schedule and a stock options plan is the most probably the traditional and probably the best way to do that. What that looks like is essentially you're giving a piece of the company to those who are helping to build it. And particularly stock options are the word option, for those of you who may not know this, it allows the members on your team to receive this benefit without a tax burden. and they only get value at the upside later as the company grows and succeeds, which is what you want everyone to be motivated around. And the way you do it is you don't do it overnight, as my colleagues just said. You do it so every certain time period there is a certain more amount of the promised equity is becomes their own as you move along.
Great questions, everybody. Thank you.
All the questions are on back.
Can you use the exercise, right?
What did you say about the journeys that you want to bring equity sharing and seeing, what is that agreement for? Are the 10 rights we need to look at? But we know before we set off this equity sharing plan, so we know that what we're getting into, we look at one template, we look at four or five different forms of various businesses. We don't really know what the answer is there.
I get a question. So, you know, there are a couple of decisions like LLC or SPARC. LLC is that if you don't want to raise money, LLC is probably a better structure from a tax standpoint because SPARC has more reporting requirements. You may need an accountant to have a SPARC, but the benefit of a SPARC is that if you want to raise money, venture capitalists would want you to be a SPARC corporation. So, something to keep in mind. So, for example, I started the company as an LLC, but 6 months into it, I knew that I'm going to raise money. So I first thing I did is that I created a quad. It takes $40 to create a quad. Like when you're starting up, you don't have to really think about reporting requirements. You just go online and build one. And the second thing you do is that if you have more than one member, let's say you have co-founders in the company, very important to make sure that you have a co-founders agreement in place. That is the biggest thing startups fail. Like one of the big reasons startups fail is that co-founders start fighting, which is very common. But you need an agreement where the key members has to stay with the company to actually get the shares. So there's a vesting schedule for the founders in the company. Mm-hmm. If somebody starts a company and 3 months down the line they have a job, they move on, they can do that. But they don't take the shares with them. So the shares come back to the company, who will stay back with the company.
We were wondering, but that's kind of a cultivation. Can you
advertise
for a certain amount of
private money? In terms of like fundraising? Yeah, you can, but you have to go to accredited investors, so you can't just go online and say, I'm raising money. There are some platforms like AngelList, you can do that. But typically there are investor or, you know, meetings that happen where you have like people who are wealthy individuals, they have money, they're accredited, and then you can say that, hey, I have this company, I'm raising, you know, $500,000, so much valuation, this is what it is, so you can do that.
Thanks, Rod. I think one of the questions I have is about attracting new talent to your organization. How do you go about doing that? How do you find that new talent? Who's, I guess, maybe bring it to the next level?
I got really lucky, I would say. I met all my talent just either, like I said, on LinkedIn. Like, literally the first person I DM'd, I guess it's a thing on LinkedIn, about coming and meeting with me. I said, hey, you're an Angular developer, and he is so fantastic. I mean, honestly, this guy, I was like the luckiest guy I meet him, and just a great entrepreneur in himself. And then I met one at a meetup here in New York City, or I'm sorry, I live in New York City now, but in Philadelphia. And he's right in the back right now. So it's really hard, but I haven't had that experience of it being hard. So I've been very lucky. Just go out and find talent, and if they suck, fire them quickly. So,
I guess in terms of finding talent, one thing very important, especially in the earlier stages of any growing company, you cannot afford a bad hire. So that's a very important first step that you need to be very, very cautious about. This is like some of the rhetoric in this space is that, you know, we'll just hire someone. They'll be so smart that they will, we'll just throw them in all 10 different directions. They'll be good. If you, it doesn't work that way either, right? And you need smart people who are problem solvers and maybe some core values like critical thinking and good communication skills. Those are the essentials but I think you need to also provide the right environment, give the right guidelines, and give the right mentorship, and mutually that is. Because at this earlier stage of a company, every addition brings their culture to add to your own culture. So what happens is you want to make sure that they're mentoring you with the fresh pair of eyes. They're looking into this, that what you're doing wrong, they have the best chance of telling you that. And if you're thick-skinned and you don't mind finding out you're stupid before you discover it much later, right? So you want to kind of encourage that. And ultimately, the finding talent, if you approach it from this perspective and you allow other team members to sit in and kind of articulate, this is how things go. And one thing that I'm proud of is that we encourage mentorship in every direction. It's mentorship up and mentorship down. If there's such a thing, we're very flat, actually. So that's something that allowed us to also attract people who want to think and kind of contribute in the ways that we are working so hard on.
So I told you I'm doing this my way, and so the way if I need more talent, I get more talent because right now I'm just running the show myself. I'm doing it, and I will grab people, but I'm being very cautious. Like I said, my gorgeous and brilliant wife said, don't put our retirement at risk. And it's working. And we're doing good in the schools. So I'm okay with it. And when I need to get to that spot and I have a sustainable model to do it, then I grow.
The only thing I'll add to that is, early on, think about hiring contractors. The reason is that you'll have more control. You know, hiring an employee, there's a lot of expectations around developing that employee, and you know, there are lots of other things that come into play. But early on, you're just trying to make sure the product is out of the door, you're meeting the timelines of the customers. So we did that. That's what I did, is hired more contractors early on to get the things moving. I had more control, more focus. Over time, what I've seen, talent something, and I don't know how much, I have hired people from a variety of places, it's very hard. It's very hard to actually really know how this person is going to work out. There are clues, like for example, if this person has been an entrepreneur and so for herself, is a big clue for us. Have they done that job before somewhere? Like for example, hiring a sales guy, have you been a sales guy? Have you been successful somewhere else? If you can afford that, then that is actually a much bigger indicator of they are going to be successful. But that we have done as we have scaled. Like my first year or two, it was like anybody willing to join me, I'm happy, you know, fine, you're kind of joining a company which is not established. There was a hit or a miss. But now we are a lot more methodical. Like we want the RPO through is that for every new hire, I make sure that there are 10 interviews that we do who are in the final stages to make one hire. If that doesn't happen, I will make the hire. Because then we have a business in a partner now.
That's getting there was somebody in the back
of the room. Can we speak to the challenges and opportunities as more quality content becomes free online by Google or on YouTube? How would you find ways to monetize in that environment?
I can take the question because we kind of play in that space. The reality is that that's going to be exponential. I think content, the quality and number is going to grow rapidly because people are getting smarter to create more content. People are putting out more content right now. The some of this content that is freely available is actually better than paid content. I mean, that's kind of one thing that folks paid out right now. So what really becomes important is curation. Because at the end of the day, you have so much of attention. So if you come to my website and within the first five seconds, if I don't show you something that you would be interested in and spend a bunch of time, which is why engagement is such a big measure for any new platform that will be successful. That's the hard part. Facebook does that, a lot of social platforms do that, but
kind of really figuring that out. How do, if people are creating content, I can't own that, but I can be the best player out there, which can do a fantastic job to provide more value to you. That's going to be, I think, in my mind, a big opportunity for everybody in this space.
So one of the things that comes to my mind is there is a little bit of the if you can't beat them, join them philosophy. Because so in my software, what I do is I integrate into Google, I integrate into Canvas, into learning management systems. And so I can ride their business a little bit, and then I adopt a pricing model that I'm certain can't be achieved otherwise for free. So I look very closely at what my competitors do, and I have wonderful competitors. I love my competitors. In fact, I even sometimes advertise for my competitors because the field that we're doing right now is so new and different that I really want to know from teachers, what is it that you like and what is it that you don't like? And then I look to see what is it that they'd be willing to pay for. So I am 100% certain the things I offer on my site are not replicated for free. All right, and I can't charge, because I'm this little guy, I can't charge a lot for my product because my barriers to entry are very small, actually. If some dweeb like me can produce it, somebody else can do it, okay? So, if for instance, you know, what would it cost, if I walked into Pearson or Houghton Mifflin or one of those big guys, and I said, you know, I have this great idea, here it is. They could say, okay, thank you very much. Turn me away. And they could replicate what I've created for, I don't know, $500,000, $1 million, something like that. Now, that might sound like a lot to you, but to them, you know, Pearson, they have, if you go into their lobby and dig between their cushions of their visitor's couch, you're going to probably pull out $500,000 right there. It's easy for them to do this. That type of thing is not a large barrier to entry. So I have to think of myself as pricing in a way. I have to control my pricing. So I can't get so high. I want to be low enough pricing so that these guys feel like it's not worth their while to come in and reproduce what I've done. Because I'm certain that they could. Okay? And so I have a lot of drivers trying to keep my prices low. That's one. And the other is that it's part of my corporate mission, because I want to put these tools into everybody's hands. So I want to keep my prices low.
Just a short comment to say, if you're not content, but context, I think, for example, I want to give Venture Cafe a shout out to say the analytics approach to that I'm one, embarrassingly, okay, and that context. So the great content is very expensive, but the context is what's usually what everyone's looking for. That's what Google says.
Yeah.
Right? So I think, it was a bit of a broad question, but I think if anyone talks about content, I'm like, immediately, no. Focus on context. Content is plenty, and everyone's creating it. Focus on context about it.
Real quick note, actually, on that, one more time. On the pricing model question, which I don't know if this is really, really a question, but I think this is very important. It's something I've discovered is that it seems as if charging very little is going to help you grow. And actually, here, I find the opposite effect. Actually, charge more. Charge too much because you validate yourself in your prices almost. People will have the questions, like, why are they so cheap? Why are they literally 50% cheaper than their competition? And they might say, it's not that I would overcharge, because the likeliness of you getting that deal is probably slim already. But if you get it, you're going to get it for something that you can make money off of. That's my opinion.
Good question. Oh, your voice.
Yeah. Right.
Go.
pricing model is great and probably needs more segmentation. So you might be going for a different segment than, say, the parent who has very little money to spend from the school district that has nothing to spend. You might want to now be the best thing. I want to jump back to the resources issue, which you talked about. And lot more always do it. I think that my background, part of my background, is in HR. And recognizing talent, I think, is the really important thing. And it is something that the self-learner here, when you're ready to bring on partners, it's the important thing is recognizing, not just going out and spending time on LinkedIn and looking at a resume, but you have to recognize and also have some relationship with the person that you're going
to. So one of my first steps would be to find somebody who can do that well, and I'll tell you why. So I've hired people tons of times at DuPont. So I worked at DuPont, and I've had to be responsible for recognizing. I always felt myself that I was one of the worst people at judging people. So I would, in other words, and that's my own fault, because I've always told myself I would give anybody 6 months to form an opinion of them. You can't do that if you hire somebody, right? You have to form an opinion in a day, or in some cases, 30 minutes, all right? And that just goes against me. I'm not the right person for that. The first person I need to hire in my business is somebody who can hire people. Because I will always give somebody the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah, your wife sounds pretty.
She's up to the challenge. She is really good. She would be
there.
The
you go.
All right. Oh, did you want
to? Just one thing I'll add is what I've seen. If I have a surmise thing, there's a good chance it might be wrong, because you know I might see some. You know, there's so many things that go into it, but a group of people hiring, having a, you know, 4 or 5 people that are different from me and then really taking the feedback has worked for me. So to your point, I guess getting the right people who can really judge and take multiple points of views.
All right, listen, this hour went by so fast, and it's a shame, because I think we have, if you're an entrepreneur, you want to know, I mean, you could have Bill Gates up here, you know, big deal. These are people actually on the street, on
these
the front
are bigger
lines.
Yeah.
These are the people you want to talk to, because they're living what you're thinking or what you're living today. So I wish we had more time, but we're out of time. So I want to thank everybody. I want to definitely thank our panel. And you know what, even more than that, I want to thank all of you for the great questions and the attention that you're paying to this. And I want you to go out with your passion. I mean, the main thing I saw here, because I'm a former Philadelphia teacher, is I saw people here that want to help, that want to have a positive change, that want to do the right thing. It's not just about making the bucks here. Because everybody wants to do that. But it's also making the bucks and doing the right thing. And if you get that vibe, that's great.
Bucks is a side product.
Side product, it'll come if it's good, right? All right, thanks, and God bless everybody.
That's it for today. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Don't forget to stay tuned for the full song, Fly, 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 by Adriana Thorpe. And check out the show notes with links to things that we talked about. Until next time, have a great week. Beside me, fly.
beside me. Fly, fly, fly. When I'm here with you, I feel.
That's it for today's episode. Thank you very much for listening. Don't forget to give Rod feedback. You can leave comments on his blog or send email to rod@rodspulsepodcast.com. The preceding audio commentary is the product of the author, Dr. Rodney Murray, and does not represent the official viewpoint of the University of the Sciences or any other institution or company.